Star Walker Studios presents Star Citizens United, a podcast dedicated to making the most of the future hit PC video game, Star Citizen. Greetings, citizen, and welcome to the Star Citizens United podcast. This week, I discuss three very unique star systems: Elis, Gauss, and Centauri. Hello, listener and citizen. Welcome to episode 18 of Star Citizens United. I'm Lex Starwalker. I'm very excited to be back in the cockpit today. So today I am continuing my series of lore episodes talking about three star systems. We're going to try to get through all three of them today: Elis, Gauss, and Centauri. Our first topic today is the Elis star system, and this is coming from, again, one of the galactic guides on the Robert Space Industries website. So I will have a link directly to this article in the show notes if you want to follow along. If speed could paradoxically be represented by a fixed point in space, then that point is unquestionably the Elis system. Home of the Murray Cup, the most famous racing event in the galaxy, Elis is a star system that plays off its reputation to any tourists or other visitors who pass within a light year of the outer worlds. Despite this, Elis is actually a very interesting star system on its own merits. From hordes of indigenous life forms that are unlike anything present anywhere else in known space, to an economy based on something other than ship part construction, to the sheer number and variety of planets present in the system, Elis is worth at least one voyage. Cosmologically, Elis is an F3V yellow star with an especially thick green band, allowing an unusually high amount of human habitation. The system is located in a highly developed region of UEE space with strong jump ties to Nexus and Killian. Politically, it's a corporate-owned star system, although this is more trivia than an actual issue of governance. Despite its association with space racing, Elis has never been a manufacturing powerhouse. Instead, it exports unrefined minerals and seafood to other populated systems in the local star cluster. I love me some seafood. I bet alien seafood is good. Elis 1 and Elis 2 are typical inter-system uninhabitable worlds. Elis 1 is a protoplanet that orbits so close to the star that it is frequently caught within solar flares. Miners consider Elis 1 the ultimate tease. Advanced scanners have revealed that the bubbling magma surface hides a fortune in rare minerals. But there is no shielding technology yet available that would allow a mining crew to access them. Dozens of pilots and crews have been killed in the attempt. Elis 2 is shrouded in a thick, smoggy atmosphere. The surface is barren and otherwise uninteresting, although the constant severe storms are an attractive diversion for observers. I think it's interesting that dozens of pilots and crews have been killed trying to get to Elis 1 to mine. You'd think that you'd send unmanned probes first to test your shielding and whatnot before you sent crews. At least that's what I would do. Green, Elis's third planet, is the most recent to be terraformed. Located on the edge of the system's inhabitable green zone, hence the unimaginative name, the world was purpose-constructed as a resort world to cater to visitors interested in the Murray Cup. A terraformed ocean world, the planet is dotted with luxury towers and mega resorts. To preserve the world's elaborate underwater reefs, only a single landing zone is allowed in the coastal city of Edo. Due to the fact that Green was terraformed, it has no native sea life. Attempts to transport species from Campos and Earth have met with abject failure. Ellis IV was the first world settled in the system, and it remains the most populated planet. It is also the only planet in the Ellis system with an economy that revolves around anything but racing. Campos is a high-gravity ocean world stocked with all manner of sea life. The planet itself is named after a particularly large sea creature, although it is not one of the many whose harvested meat is available for export. Campos' high gravity also gave rise to the evolution of flat cats, which formed the basis of a brief fad in the UEE core worlds. The world is frequently called Seahorse by the locals, so named for the appearance of some of the high-gravity sea monsters harvested by native fishermen. The third of Ellis's populated planets, Noble, Ellis V, is a mid-sized forest world. The planet is largely unremarkable, with corporate dictates requiring that most of the surface be preserved as is. A single spaceport near the South Polar region allows visitors to explore a beautiful landscape reminiscent of an undeveloped Earth. Two moons make for an especially beautiful landscape at night, although there is a consistent fear that urban development will spread on the world to support the ever-increasing number of race fans traveling to the system. Ellis 6 sits just outside the Green Band, a rocky terrestrial world that is currently being used by the UEE for research into human habitation. The hope is that terraforming techniques will expand to the point that planets farther and farther from a star will be able to someday support a human biosphere. A small science station is in geostationary orbit for this purpose, and the population of scientists are always eager to purchase luxury goods to while away the time spent at their thankless tasks. Ellis 7 and 8 are similarly uninhabitable worlds. 7 features a highly corrosive atmosphere that can be damaging to ships entering low orbit. Ellis 8 is the smallest full world in the system, an uninteresting rock with a limited atmosphere. The Ellis system features two gas giants, Ellis 9, known as Walleye, and Ellis 10. Walleye is the largest of the two and has been completely commercialized as a fueling world. While Walleye is most famously recognized as a pit stop for racers, most of the time it is the site of impressive queues of freighters and warships waiting to take on fuel. Long-haul transports making the Earth Pinecone Run frequently begin at Walleye, and a variety of rest stop facilities have grown up in orbit. Ellis 10, called Bombora, is a smaller gas giant with an extremely turbulent atmosphere. Scooping fuel can be extremely dangerous, and pilots are advised to avoid any such attempt. On the other hand, it is a chance to skip the wait at Walleye and refuel your ship at no cost. So that sounds like that might be kind of fun to try. I hope this is something we can attempt in-game, trying to scoop some fuel from Ellis 10. The 11th planet in the Ellis system was famously destroyed recently in a collision with its moon. The impact resulted in an extremely dense debris field, which pilots are advised to avoid at all costs. Outlying regions are a reasonable source for minerals, though, with gravity having already begun the refining process. Ellis 12, named Judeca, is a small frozen ball in space, the site of the occasional ice mining expedition and little else. The outermost planet in the system, Ellis 13, is known locally as Pinecone due to its strange shattered rock surface. Pinecone is rich in heavy minerals and is a popular destination for long-haul miners, many of whom transport ores all the way back to Earth itself for resale. So there's a little bit about the Ellis system from the Galactic Guide. Sounds like an interesting place with more going on than just the Murray Cup, although that might be why you first go there. And stay for the seafood, right? So next we're going to talk about the Gauss system. And this is from another Galactic Guide, and I will have a link to this article in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. So go check it out if you want to follow along. The Gauss system is the epitome of natural beauty on a grand scale. Located at the forefront of a massive emission nebula, the Olympus Pool, this binary star system is so stunningly different from anything else in space that early explorers could not believe what they had happened across. Massive permanent bands of turquoise, gold, and deep orange expand infinitely across the sky in brilliant patterns from any viewpoint in the system. Like the Grand Canyon on Earth or the magnetic ridge on Terra, Goss exists first and foremost as a tourist destination, with little to offer those not interested in taking in the sights. Goss was initially settled by a plethora of naturalistic religious groups, likely motivated by the belief that the system's majestic nebulascape would allow them to better commune with their deities. As a result, the population today prides itself on its self-sufficiency, producing their own goods with little excess. The end result is that Goss is no place for a bulk trader. Small haulers are another story. Between handmade Gossian goods, mountains of assorted tourist knickknacks, and the rare life forms native to the system's inhabitable worlds, there are plenty of high-demand goods available in small numbers. It's a great way for an Aurora or a 300i pilot with a smaller cargo hold to supplement their vacation. Hey, there you go, if you've got one of those ships or something like it. Or, in the case of the more restricted life forms, a way for a pilot living outside the law to make quite a bit of a profit. Okay, well, that's pretty despicable. Starwalker Studios does not condone such actions. The UEE military also regularly utilizes Goss as a port of call for shore leave for their longer duration frontier-facing fleets. Civilians would do well to avoid the nightclubs and other hotspots on Castle when a UEE carrier group is in orbit. The servicemen visiting the planet in such instances have usually been in space for 8 to 12 months without relief, and enter the atmosphere looking for a good time. Local authorities are used to these visits and generally look the other way. There is also a large military hospital complex on Goss 3, the ultimate destination for warriors wounded in battle with the Vanduul. The innermost planet in Goss is an abundant world, considered the system's breadbasket. From mineral-rich mountain ranges to endless fields for farming, Goss 1 produces 98% of the resources required to sustain both the system's natives and the tourists who frequent the system. There is no room for out-system trade, though. Almost everything produced on Goss 1 is shipped to the other two worlds in the system. Extremely short-haul pilots are sometimes in demand for these runs, although it's dull work that produces a very small paycheck. All of the property on Goss 1 is owned by natives, and the world's laws are incredibly strict about blocking outsiders, and corporations specifically, from ever gaining a foothold. Unlike most other successful biospheres, Goss 1 has almost no ocean. The single largest body of water, roughly the size of Earth's Mediterranean Sea, is filled with stagnant water that is almost entirely devoid of life, with the lone exception being a moss-covered quasi-shrimp. Attempts to introduce some of the varied life forms from Castle or elsewhere in the Empire have resulted in abject failure. For reasons yet to be determined, aquatic life cannot adapt here. Okay, and next we talk about Goss 2 Castle, which I see here, I'm pronouncing it wrong, but I cannot comprehend how they want me to pronounce it. Cassel? Yeah, we need a little help with these phonetic spellings here. I'll call it Cassel, I guess. Is the resort world of the Goss system, the ultimate destination of hundreds of millions of human tourists every year. As opposed to Goss 1, Cassel is a beautiful ocean world. 85% of the world consists of vibrant, life-filled oceans, and most of the rest is home to tropical rainforests. As an aside here, I'm a little worried here that Star Citizen is following the trope made so popular by Star Wars of having planets that just have one type of ecosystem. And those aren't remotely realistic. I mean, we just talked about a forest world, and now this is a ocean and tropical rainforest world. And I hope that these articles are just taking some artistic license and that they're really, this world isn't just oceans and rainforests, because that isn't possible. Cities on Cassel have formed around the original landing arcologies established by Gaussian colonists hundreds of years prior. Massive resort towns have also sprung up along the thousands of miles of beautiful coastlines. These are the ultimate destination for tourists. Whether you are here to view the Olympus Pool reflected on the pristine oceans or to frequent the planet's infamous nightclubs, there is something for everyone on Cassel. Cassel is home to one of the most complex aquatic ecospheres in the explored galaxy, with hundreds of thousands of complex species identified and many more lurking in the depths. Cassel's seas are a sight to behold. Cassel is also home to the Midas fish, a naturally golden animal which has become symbolic of its homeworld and prized in fish tanks throughout the galaxy. Do you have a Midas fish in your fish tank? Other native creatures include the eerie Lang crab and the mammalian Zee whale. Licenses to ship live animals are few and far between. There is a teeming black market for anyone willing to ship expensive fish off-world. And once again, Star Walker Studios does not condone these actions. Gauss 3 is a small subtropical world that is the acknowledged property of the UEE. The planet is largely undeveloped, although it is home to a mid-sized naval refitting base and the aforementioned hospital complex. Gauss 3 is generally closed to visitors, although anyone who has business with the military facilities established there can acquire a landing pass with relative ease. The dark side of the Gauss system is that the system's nebula also acts as an effective curtain for nearby pirate operations. Pirate organizations have been known to base themselves in the outer gases of the Olympus Pool and raid shipping or conduct illegal trade. It is believed that at least one standing pirate facility exists within the pool, as well as standard rendezvous coordinates for several narcotics runs. Tourists should avoid this region of space entirely. Its denizens are especially brazen, given the frequency of UEE shore leave visits to Gauss, although some theorize that the UEE actually encourages piracy in the region as it gives newly trained pilots a ready source of target practice. So I have to say, if I was going to be a pirate in Star Citizen, this sounds like a great place to make my base, if only for the view, right? Of course, I don't know if I like the idea of new recruit Navy pilots coming and shooting at me all the time, but maybe if you get in a nice, far out, very dense part of the nebula, they won't find you. All right, and for the last system that I'm going to talk about today, the Centauri system, which consists of five planets and three known jump points surrounding a large Type A main sequence star. Centauri was one of the first systems settled during humanity's initial period of interstellar expansion. It was discovered in 2365 by a dedicated survey ship that immediately recognized the tremendous colonization potential of the third planet. The flag was quickly planted on Centauri 3, and the land there was immediately offered at a premium to colonial outfitting groups. The result was Sisei, I have a problem with this one every time, one of the most beautiful and well-constructed human worlds in the UEE. In the development process, the other worlds in the system went largely ignored. In the ensuing centuries, scattered resources have been discovered on these other worlds, and more scattershot development has taken place. So, speaking of Sisei and my problems figuring out how to pronounce that every time I see it, I was watching Around the Verse last week, and they had one of their new employees, Sherry Heiberg, on, who's their new archivist, and she's doing awesome things over at CIG. And one of the things she wants to do is establish pronunciation guides for all this crazy stuff, which I am totally on board with, as I'm trying to relay this stuff to you. You know, I do my best just looking at the word and thinking how it might be pronounced. But as is the case with Cassel that I just talked about a few minutes ago, I really thought it was castle by the way it was spelled, and then find out that's wrong. Although I'm still not sure what the right pronunciation is, because right now there doesn't seem, when we're given pronunciations, there doesn't seem to be any standardized method of doing that. And of course, there are already established, you know, ways to give pronunciations. So I'm really looking forward to them getting that done and having a consistent pronunciation guide for us. So not only do you have words spelled phonetically for you, but you also have a guide somewhere that tells you what those phonetic spellings mean. Because without that, it's kind of difficult, you know, when you have a bunch of different people spelling things phonetically in a bunch of different ways. So I am really looking forward to that for obvious reasons. It will make what I'm doing here a lot easier. And I like to say things right, you know, if there is a right way. And something I'm curious about to see if they do anything with it with is, you know, if you think about, for instance, English, if you live here in the United States or if you live anywhere else where English is your primary language, then you know that not everybody speaks English the same, right? There are tons of words that people in different places pronounce different ways, and not even comparing the way someone in New Zealand and the way someone in the United States would pronounce it, but just people in different areas of the United States will pronounce different words different ways. So that's something interesting that I always want to see people, more so in fantasy, but like in Star Citizen, I'd love to see something done with that. And it looks like they're doing that a little bit. For instance, the Kessel system, you know, they mentioned in the little write-up that the natives of the system are offended when people call it castle. So there's a nod to the fact that different people are going to pronounce things different ways, and that, you know, that system, the natives of the system call it Kessel, but outsiders will often call it castle, which annoys the natives. And I think those kinds of things are kind of cool. Or to say, oh, well, this word is pronounced like this by people from these areas, and it's pronounced like that by people from those areas. And that's really interesting. And so that's often kind of how I explain things. I play a lot of role-playing games in a lot of fantasy role-playing games. And as anybody who's read fantasy knows, fantasy authors love to just make up weird names and then find the most awkward way to spell them possible, because I guess they think that makes it more exotic or something, but it makes it a nightmare for the reader to know how to pronounce things. And so in a game, you will often have, you know, players pronouncing words in different ways. And I often just tell them not to worry about it and say, well, hey, you're from a different part of the world where that's how they pronounce that thing. So I think that's cool stuff. So I'm really looking forward to the pronunciation guide, and I'm really looking forward to the possibility that we may have various pronunciations for some words depending on where in the UEE you're at. You know, so if you're from Terra, you might pronounce this name this way, and if you're from Earth, you might pronounce it another way, and that'd be pretty cool. And we know that CIG does not shy away from complexity, so I think it's possible. Centauri's innermost world is a tiny protoplanet that orbits very close to the star. Centauri 1 has no atmosphere and no mineable resources. The close-up view of Centauri's star from orbit, however, is overwhelming. A well-known photograph, commonly available as a postcard, taken by the initial system survey ship, shows the blue-white star with a prominence reaching out to seemingly grab the tiny planet. Centauri 2, called Yar, was initially a Venusian world that has since been terraformed by the UEE. It's from Venus? I'm confused. What they mean by Venusian world? Its proximity to the sun makes for an arid environment, and the planet is largely covered by the red desert. Decidedly, its identifying feature from orbit. Maybe they mean that it's a hellishly hot, high-pressure world. Maybe that's what they mean by Venusian. Or is Venusian like a race in Star Citizen or something? I don't know. I don't know what they mean by that. Let's see. Where was I? Yar is dotted with research stations, commercial layover points, and abandoned settlements, many of which are coated in the planet's fine red sand, and a significant number of which are being reclaimed entirely by the red desert. Although it's not quite a ghost planet, many visitors report being left with a sense of unease among its abandoned facilities. Why is there development in the first place? Yar underwent an unexpected land grab roughly a century ago after valuable precious minerals were located in a mountain range. These claims petered out quickly, and human civilization on the planet has been in a clear decline since. The world's largest landing pad is Archibald Station, a scientific outpost that grew into a small town and then shrank back to an outpost as interest in the planet waned. Other landing zones on the planet continue to remain functional, although unmaintained. Enough infrastructure remains on the planet to support passing spacecraft, although the small population needs only essentials from traders. And now we have the always unpronounceable Sisei, the third planet, and the reason to visit Centauri. A beautifully terraformed world, Sisei has been planned and cultivated for human habitation since the initial survey. Sisei is one of the only worlds in explored space where the Governor's Council has imposed a population cap, limiting the number of inhabitants to preserve the environment. Despite their similarly limited populations, Sisei stands in sharp contrast to Yar as a jewel of human development. I think it's funny that they're capitalizing human in here. Centauri was first surveyed in 2365, and bids for Centauri 3 went on the market almost immediately. The winning group, Adjust Colonial, consisted largely of earthen Japanese expatriates who carried over design foundations and other cultural memes from their homeland to the landfall location at Fujin City. Sisei's own culture has veered in unique directions since this time, influenced by earthly tradition, but having become something completely unique. In addition to natural beauty, organic construction, and a limited population, Centauri is also known as the headquarters of MISC, the ship concern responsible for much of the UEE's heavy vehicle traffic. And I talked about MISC just an episode or two ago. So this sounds really cool. I'm really curious about Sisei and the culture and kind of the aesthetic there. Sounds really cool. I'm definitely looking forward to checking that out. Fujin City is the landing point for most visitors to Sisei. It boasts a fully automated high-volume landing zone, Sisei Landing Consortium. Say that 20 times really fast. Personal hangars here are few and far between, with real estate everywhere on the world going for high UEC values. The city features all the comforts of home, from an Astro Armada ship dealer to an advocacy field office. Downtown Fujin is home to the MISC corporate showroom, where visitors can see the latest Freelancer, Starfarer, and bulk transport hauls on display. At the heart of the city is Nessa Park, a beautifully cultivated park designed as an oasis for city workers involved in high-tech industries all day. The central MISC factory is located in the city's outer environs, a carefully crafted automated setup that has been duplicated on many other worlds. The majority of MISC Starfarers are currently constructed in this facility and then shipped off-world on massive enclosed ship transports. A great deal of other heavy industry takes place on Sisei, but always planned in an environmentally respectful manner. The result is a massive export of ship components, luxury items, and other heavy industry that would seem to be completely at odds with Sisei's well-deserved reputation as the cleanest planet in the known galaxy. The message to other human worlds is clear: planning pays off. That sounds really cool. I can't wait to go check out Sisei. That sounds awesome. Something for everybody, huh? Centauri 4 is a rocky world with one interesting feature. It completely lacks a molten core. As a coreless world, the planet never developed an electromagnetic field and was never able to retain a serious atmosphere. Archaeological studies have revealed that it had a limited atmosphere for some time, but that solar wind impacts ultimately fully eliminated it roughly 3,000 years ago. Due to its proximity to the system's asteroid belt, Centauri 4 has been heavily impacted by asteroid strikes. The world is considered a potential candidate for terraforming, albeit a very poor one. The need for special technology and resources to construct a core would be an incredibly expensive and technically difficult proposition. Yeah, it seems like that would be more effort than it would be worth. Beyond Centauri 4 lies a dense asteroid belt, the only one in the system. Although the Centauri belt contains enough mass to form a planet, for whatever reason, it has never come together. The region is rich in standard heavy metals, and pop-up mining bases frequently appear to support Sisei's heavy industry. The system's outermost planet, Centauri 5, is a massive super-Jupiter, a red and yellow gas giant several times the size of those normally encountered. The world's atmosphere makes an excellent stopover for long-haul transport seeking fuel, but it has not been otherwise developed. So there you go. There's the Centauri system and the Gauss system and the Ellis system. Really, really cool stuff. And I'm really impressed. We've talked about a few systems now on the show, and I'm really impressed with how, you know, they're not only detailing just like one or two planets in each system, but they're really going into all of the planets in each system, which is really, really cool. And I'm also impressed with the variety in the planets as far as what kind of culture is there and what goes on there and things like that. Really awesome. I'm a little bit wondering about the, you know, this is a forest world stuff, but that could just be, you know, writers overstating things a bit, right? So we'll have to see. And I mean, even if that's the way it turns out, we've seen a lot of that in science fiction, and it's a trope, and I don't personally like it. I prefer more realism, but what are you going to do? This is really cool stuff, and all of these places, when I read about them, I just can't wait to go check them out in game and go explore. And, you know, I'm not sure how much fidelity there's going to be in system. I'm assuming a lot just because this is Star Citizen. But I'm wondering, you know, when we go into a system, are we going to be able to visit all of the different worlds in the system, even if there's not anything going on there? And are we going to be able to land on them all? That's really interesting. And obviously, you know, there's a limit to what can be done. So I'm guessing that a planet like Sisei, you know, there's probably a few cities or places that you can go, but you're not going to be able to go like anywhere on the planet because that would be crazy. But really awesome stuff. So that is going to wrap up episode 18 of Star Citizens United. Thank you so much for strapping in and flying with me on yet another episode. If you would like to reach me, you can email me at scupodcast@gmail.com. You can find me on Google+, just look for Lex Starwalker, and you can follow me on Twitter at Lex Starwalker. Please visit the website starwalkerstudios.com, where you can find the show notes for this episode of Star Citizens United and find links to the articles I discussed, and you can also find the other podcasts I produce there. So once again, I want to thank you so much for flying with me and tuning in for another episode. I really appreciate it. I'm having a lot of fun with these. And definitely let me know what you think about the lore episodes. And let me know what you think. So far, I've been getting a lot of good feedback from people that are really enjoying the lore stuff. And I'm really digging it. And this is a great way for me to not only kind of dive into this stuff myself, but to share it with you. And there's a lot. I mean, the game isn't even out yet. We're still in alpha. And there is so much on the website as far as lore to go through. And it can be difficult, you know, to find time where you can sit at your computer or sit with your tablet or whatever and read all this. So I'm really happy to put this out in podcast form so you can listen to this while you're in your car or on the subway or the bus or whatever. And I'm having a lot of fun with it. So let me know what you think, and if you have any requests for topics to cover on the show, let me know. So once again, I'm Lex Starwalker. I will be back next week with more Star Citizen lore. Until then, hopefully I'll see you out there. This has been a Starwalker Studios production. your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts. Please see all that Starwalker Studios has to offer at starwalkerstudios.com.